denial could entirely undo the damage caused. Now, Pryor found himself compelled to rebut allegations of complicity where there was none, and by doing so, reinforce the effect of the lie, and pressured into attempting to disprove something that could not be disproved because no empirical evidence of its reality had ever been offered to begin with. Even his latest girlfriend had ceased taking his calls. The only people who did sound happy to hear from him were his lawyers, because he was paying them by the hour for conversation. Sometimes the price was worth it, just for some civil discourse. Pryor had money. The lawyer's fees were eating into his funds, but he was in no danger of penury, not by some distance. But what good was money when a man couldn't eat where he wished, travel when he desired, socialize with those whom he once called friends? What good was money without influence? His life was in limbo. He was doing nothing with his days, yet had to take pills to help him sleep. Despite his awareness of the strategies being used to pressure him, he could not deny their effectiveness. Why should he protect those who had lost faith in him so quickly? Why not simply make an approach to the feds and offer to tell them what he knew of the backers in return for a new life far from here? Because I would be exchanging one form of restriction for another. I could never sit with my back to a door. I would never be able to close my eyes at night without armed men to guard me. I would always be fearful, and they would find me in the end. Pryor entered his apartment building. The doorman was absent, but the mailroom behind the reception desk was open, and music played softly from inside. Pryor was content not to have to exchange pleasantries, even in his current state of isolation. The feds had searched his apartment thoroughly as part of the investigation, and his name had been in the papers, so the doorman knew of his troubles, just like everyone else on the block. They looked at him differently now, and their greetings were offered reluctantly when they came at all. He took the elevator to the sixth floor. No one joined him, which was a further mercy. He shifted his bag of groceries as he reached for his key. The contents didn't amount to much, nutritionally speaking, but he took his consolations where he could. He still retained membership of his health club, but he was too well known there to be able to concentrate on exercise, and so he had put on 10 pounds since the start of the investigation. His suits no longer fit as comfortably as before, but this was a minor inconvenience, since he no longer had any reason to wear them. How had the FBI targeted those whom it was investigating and arresting? This was the question that troubled Pryor as the feds continued to spread their net. Despite what the backers believed, the names had not come from him. It was possible someone else was leaking information, but the targets were so random. Politicians, clergy, police, government employees, business executives, that the source could only be an individual with knowledge of the backer's entire network. And the targets were deeply embedded. Some had been compromised or had allied themselves willingly to the cause decades before. None was a recent convert. An old list of conspirators, then. The old list. It was believed to have been lost or destroyed. But what if this was untrue? What if someone had found it and shared its contents with the FBI? Yet if that were the case, surely the feds would have moved against everyone on it. Why this picking and choosing of unconnected individuals, other than as part of an ongoing effort to turn the screws on Pryor himself? Could someone be feeding selected names from the list to the FBI while retaining possession of the actual document? Who might that be? The name came to him as he opened the door. Why had he not considered it before? Because he had been too absorbed in his own problems, too mired in self-pity. Now, at last, he was beginning to think clearly. Parker. It had to be. He had the contacts and the will. Pryor closed the door behind him, placing the groceries on the kitchen table before moving into the dining room. It was still early afternoon. He would call his lawyers and ask for a meeting to be arranged, that evening, if possible, with a representative of Granger and Mellon, who acted for the backers in all legal matters. He would present his suspicions to them. He didn't even have to establish a pattern. The pattern was that there was no pattern. He stopped. A peculiar smell came to him. Perfume. And whatever the perfume was imperfectly disguising. He turned as a shadow moved against the wall to his left, and a pain entered his neck and spread quickly through the rest of his body. Within seconds he was on the floor, and oblivion followed. Chapter 77. In the 19th century, a seam of fine-grained schist, a layered metamorphic rock that can easily be split into plates, was discovered in the vicinity of Cape Elizabeth, Maine. A schistose structure is generally unsuited to construction materials. But in the case of the Cape Elizabeth schist, the rock broke readily into jointed blocks ideal for building. This led to its use in structures around Portland. Although the Cape Elizabeth stone later became identifiable through severe staining caused by the oxidation of the pyrite in the blocks. Two quarries were opened in Cape Elizabeth to access the schist, one larger than the other. The smaller and shallower of the two, known as the Grundy Quarry after its former owner, the Grundy Granite Company, was now the access point for a nature trail popular with residents and tourists during the summer months, but relatively unused in the off-season. With the change in weather and the return of migrant birds, birders and hikers would soon be tramping its pathways once again, and local volunteers were already preparing to cut back some of the vegetation and pick up the trash. But for now, the Grundy Quarry was still a useful spot for teenage drinking, pot-smoking, and necking. If teenagers still necked, which they probably didn't. Necking being a too quaint term for the kind of activities that would have caused Austin Grundy, a staunch Baptist, to spin in his grave had he known of the uses to which the environs of his quarry were being put by the youth of today. Four male representatives of that same demographic were currently availing of the Grundy Quarry in order to drink and smoke, if not to neck, each of the quartet being resolutely heterosexual. Even if two of them had not yet managed to explore this inclination to any practical effect. Although it was raining, three wooden shelters stood around the quarry's circumference, each with a bench table, making them perfectly suited to the illicit consumption of beer, while the damp weather meant that the chances of being disturbed by adults, particularly cops, were slim to none. The water at the base of the quarry was relatively shallow, but very murky. Nobody in recent memory had tried to swim in it, and during the summer, its surface bore a permanent haze of insects. But a combination of rain and snowmelt had served to raise the water level, and it was into this pool that Josh Lindley, at 17, the youngest, brightest, and shyest of the group, was now gazing from above. Josh was feeling philosophical. Although that might just have been an effect of the alcohol, he had a high life, the champagne of beers in hand. Although Josh figured that if champagne tasted like high life, he couldn't see what all the fuss was about. On the other hand, high life tasted better than some of the stuff they'd been forced by necessity to imbibe at their little gatherings. He still recalled the two-day hangover he'd endured after Troy Egan secured for them 6 40-ounce bottles of Old English 800, NWA playing through the speaker of Troy's phone as they toasted the late Easy E, who had favored OE 800 back in the day. Only later, when he was once again able to hold down solid food, did Josh discover that OE 800 was regarded by some experts as possibly the worst beer in the world. Although it hadn't tasted so bad to him at the time. It was beer, and how bad could beer be? Pretty bad, as it turned out. The sound of a huge splash broke his contemplation. Troy Egan and his cousin Devin hoisting another gray block over the quarry edge. Someone had dumped a bunch of them behind one of the shelters. Assholes sometimes did that because the area around the quarry was so easy to access from the road. Folk could drive up to it and toss their old recliners, refrigerators, or ovens into the water, although most just left their crap on the grass for the town to haul away.
"There she blows!"
Troy shouted, and Devin laughed, even though Josh was sure that Devin Egan had no idea what the phrase meant and was only laughing because Troy was laughing. Over at a shelter, the fourth member of their little band, Scott Vitesse, was trying to find the right dance playlist on Spotify.
"Come on, guys," said Scott. "Enough!" "One more," said Troy. "This one'll be like a depth charge exploding. It's a monster."
And it was. No way were Troy and Devin going to be able to lift that block between them.
"Josh," Troy called. "Get over here. You too, Betty."
Josh wandered over to join them, as did Scott, even though he was pissed at being called Betty rhymes with Vetty. Josh had to admit that the block was likely to make a hell of an impact. He drained the last of his beer and put the bottle on the ground. Although he could not have known it, this was the final high life he would ever consume. From that day forth, even looking at the label would bring back unpleasant memories. Together, the four boys managed to maneuver the block to the rim of the quarry, where it teetered, waiting for the final push.
"Bombs away!"
said Troy, and Devin laughed again, and down the block went, striking the rock face as it went, dislodging a chunk of stone before bouncing out to strike where the quarry was deepest. An enormous eruption of water followed, just like a torpedo, as Troy had promised. Devin whooped, and the others joined in. But their cries faded away, until only Devin's voice could still be heard, before he, too, grew quiet. The rear of a car had emerged from the water, forced up from the uneven quarry bed by the impact of the block on the hood. The trunk popped open, revealing the body of a woman tied up inside. Josh Lindley didn't move, didn't speak, didn't puke. He didn't even want to keep staring, but he did because he couldn't look away, no matter how hard he tried. And then he realized that he had turned away, but he was still seeing the body in the trunk, and he knew that he would keep seeing it no matter what. And this was one of the burdens he would bear into adulthood, into old age, into the grave. He took out his cell phone and dialed 911. Over by the shelter, Troy Egan was already disposing of the beer. Chapter 78. Garrison Pryor opened his eyes. He was lying naked in his bathtub, his hands restrained behind his back, his legs and mouth bound with tape. A woman was sitting on the toilet seat next to him. Pale skin, gray eyes, near white hair, beneath a light blue plastic skullcap. Less a living being than a washed-out image of one, like a picture fading from the world. Pryor's head felt too heavy. He forced himself to lift it, and it banged sharply against the faucet behind him. The effort exhausted what little energy he had left, so he stayed as he was, with the faucet digging uncomfortably into his skull. His extremities hurt, and it was all he could do not to throw up against the gag for fear that he might choke if he did. He watched the woman, and the woman watched him. The more he looked, the worse she appeared, as though the profound ugliness within her could not conceal itself from close regard. Her hands were folded before her, making her seem almost prim in her posture. Pryor could see no weapon and experienced the first stirrings of hope. Perhaps this was just a warning, the backers reminding him of his obligations to them. They had to be responsible for this woman's presence in his apartment, because no one else would dare to risk such an incursion. If he could only induce her to take the tape from his mouth, he could tell her what he had deduced about the list, about Parker. He would ask her to make a call, and this would all be over. He tried to speak, using his eyes to indicate the gag. He just wanted the chance to explain. The woman raised her hands from her lap, revealing a slim leather pouch. She opened it on the marble countertop to her right, exposing a series of blades, hooks, and pliers that gleamed in the artificial light. Next to them was a square of plastic, which she unfolded into a poncho before slipping it over her head. She stood, allowing the material to settle as far as her knees, protecting her clothing. Finally, she donned a pair of plastic gloves.
"Just so you know, they stipulated that it should be painful."
She selected a long-bladed scalpel from the pouch.
"I'm afraid we're going to make a mess."
Chapter 79. Parker took the call from Moxie Caston while waiting to board for Cincinnati. He regretted not taking an earlier flight from Logan because this one was a zoo, but he'd been unable to reschedule a morning meeting regarding witnesses in an assault case that was due to go to trial in a couple of days.
"Bad news," said Moxie. "They found Malalambati's body."
Parker stepped out of line and walked over to an empty gate so they could speak without being overheard.
"Where?" "The bottom of Grundy Quarry. There's no positive ID yet, but it looks like someone rolled Lombardi's car into the water with her locked in the trunk."
Parker watched the line grow shorter as the plane filled. Moxie was paying for a first-class ticket, so he wasn't concerned about finding space for his hand baggage. The question was whether he should board the flight at all, but it didn't take him long to come up with an answer. There was nothing he could offer the police that might help with the Lombardi investigation. What he could do was travel to Indiana as planned and find out what Layla Patton knew or suspected about the death of Errol Doby and the disappearance of his girlfriend Esther Bachmeier. Karras linked Doby, Bachmeier, and Lombardi, and Layla Patton, who had worked for Doby, was frightened. Parker wanted to ask her why that might be.
"No word from our caller?" he said.
"None."
"When he does get in touch, use Lombardi. You need to frighten him into coming forward. That way we can protect him, Karras's son, and anyone else who knows the truth about what happened. Keep Louis close until I get back. Find him a chair in a quiet corner."
The line for his flight was gone, and Parker heard his name being called.
"I have to go."
Chapter 80. Holly Weaver and her father were half-watching the evening news, which was broadcasting live from the road outside Grundy Quarry, police and forensic vehicles congregating in the background, just as they had for the discovery of Karras.
"Christ,"
said Holly. But the word held no real sense of shock, and suggested only a general disgust at the willingness of human beings to inflict suffering on one another. The news was also little more than a distraction for Owen Weaver, who was sitting in an adjacent armchair drinking a beer. The body at the quarry was someone else's problem. They had their own to deal with. His daughter continued to procrastinate about meeting in person with the lawyer Caston. He couldn't blame her. Sitting down with him would set in motion a train of events that might well conclude with her losing Daniel, temporarily if not permanently, and one or both of the adults ending up in jail. But Holly was also angry with her father. He'd shared with her exactly what he'd said to the lawyer, and her response had been that he'd told Caston too much. He'd revealed Karras's name and the sex of her child, and that wasn't what they'd agreed. Owen had to admit he might have become a bit confused when talking with Caston, and maybe he should have guarded his tongue more. But like most sensible people, he'd spent a lifetime trying to avoid lawyers. Dealing with one of them directly even over the phone, had given him a bad case of the jitters. Holly turned away from the television.
"I've changed my mind,"
she said. "You can't change it, not now."
"I can, and I have. If we come forward, they'll take Daniel away. If we stay quiet, there's still a good chance that no one will ever find out the truth. It'll all die down soon because the police have bigger worries, like finding the men who killed that trooper, and now the body dumped at the quarry. How much longer are they going to spend looking for a child?"
"But Caston knows."
"What does he know? A name, and that Karis gave birth to a boy, that's all."
"If I don't call back, he'll go to the police."
"Let him."
"What about the private investigator?"
"What can he do? Force the parents of every 5-year-old boy in the state to take a DNA test? If he shows up, I'll give him the name of every man I ever slept with. Hell, I'll even make up a few more to bring it into double figures, and he can take a guess at which one I decided not to add to the birth certificate."
Her father winced. Like every man with a daughter, there was a small part of him that wished to embrace the concept of a virgin birth.
"Holly!"
"Daniel's mine. It's my decision. I've made it, so we're done talking."
She stumped to the kitchen, where he heard her crashing about, pulling out pots for dinner. He wasn't about to try and argue with her further, not for the present. He'd endured conversations like this with her late mother, after whom Holly took in so many ways, and a man learned when to retreat. And it might even have been that Holly was right. The advantages of confessing were only marginal, and perhaps it would all blow over, the whole business ultimately being consigned to a file in a basement somewhere in Augusta. The doorbell rang. Daniel was on a play date with one of his buddies and was due to be dropped home right about now. But when Owen opened the door, it was Sheila Barham standing on the doorstep. The Barhams owned the property to the east of the Weavers, and both families enjoyed good relations, although the Barhams were closer in age to Owen than Holly, and their kids had long since left home to make kids of their own. Daniel sometimes stayed with the Barhams if Holly had to work late and Owen was away, although Daniel complained about the kind of TV the Barhams watched, mostly old game shows and religious programming, and the fact that every meal came with broccoli. Owen invited Sheila to step inside, and Holly greeted her from the kitchen. "Everything okay?" Owen asked.
"Kinda, sorta," said Sheila. "Look, it may be nothing, but I saw someone snooping around your place earlier today."
"What kind of someone?" Owen asked.
"Well, it was a woman. I saw her from the kitchen. She looked dirty, and I don't think she was wearing any shoes. I guess it might have been some homeless person. She seemed to be trying the windows, probably hoping to climb through and steal something. I called Henry and told him to send her on her way, because who knows how long the police might have taken to get here."
Henry Barham was a big man and a Vietnam veteran. Owen wouldn't have fucked with Henry Barham for a bucket full of silver dollars. Holly joined them.
"What happened?"
"Sheila says a woman might have tried to break into the house earlier."
"She was gone by the time Henry got here,"
Sheila continued.
"He didn't think she'd managed to get inside, but we have a key, so he checked, just in case. He did the same for your place, Owen. I hope you don't mind."
Owen had gone to the bank that afternoon, which was the only reason he hadn't been around.
"No," said Owen, "not at all."
"We're grateful to you both for your care," said Holly. "We thought we'd leave it up to you if you wanted to report it to the police. We're always around anyway. You know Henry. He don't like to leave the house much except to go to church." "I don't think we'll bother the police with it,"
said Holly, carefully avoiding her father's eye.
"We'll make sure the alarms are set and the doors and windows are locked. Don't mention it to Daniel, though. I wouldn't want to worry him."
Sheila agreed that keeping it between themselves would probably be for the best. They thanked her again, and she went on her way.
"Odd, huh?"
said Holly. "No police?" said Owen. "You sure?"
"You want me to get it tattooed on my forehead? We're not talking to the police. Not about anything."
"I think I can remember that,"
Owen took his coat from the rack and a flashlight from the drawer beneath. Maybe I'll take a look outside, just for the fresh air. He made circuits of the two houses. The only signs of any attempted intrusion were by Daniel's window, where the flashlight picked up muddy streaks on the wood and glass, the kind dirty fingers might have left in an effort to open it. Owen used the sleeve of his coat to wipe them away. Like Holly said, no point in frightening the boy. Chapter 81. The call came through to Billy Ocean's cell phone as he was cleaning up trash from outside the 12-unit Sunlight Haven apartments in South Portland. The complex was the highest earner in the Stonehurst residential property portfolio, with a mature sheltered garden to the rear and bright high-ceilinged rooms. It rented to Caucasians only. Didn't matter what kind of bank references any non-whites might be able to conjure up. A top-floor unit was currently vacant, and Billy had a viewing scheduled in an hour. But someone had thrown a couple of garbage bags over by the dumpsters, and they'd burst on landing, scattering crap all over the yard. Now Billy was chasing after wind-blown food wrappers and picking up pieces of rotten fruit, and thinking that life really did seem determined to shit in his shoes. He looked at the screen of his phone, but the number was withheld. He hated it when people did that, and usually let those calls go to voicemail. On this occasion he picked up, just in case it was the couple coming to view the apartment, and they'd had to borrow a phone. The voice on the other end of the line sounded as though it should be announcing that dinner was served on one of those dull British masterpiece shows that his mother loved to watch.
"Am I speaking to Mr. Stonehurst?"
the voice asked.
"You are?" "Mr. William Stonehurst?"
Billy couldn't remember the last time anyone other than his mother had called him William, and she only used his full name when she was pissed at him.
"Yeah, who's this?"
"My name is Quayle. I believe I may know who was responsible for setting fire to your truck."
Chapter 82. Daniel Weaver woke to the sound of scratching at his window. The drapes were closed, and the house was otherwise quiet. His mom had gone to bed shortly after Daniel returned from his playdate, and Grandpa Owen was already back at his own place by then, so Daniel didn't get to see him at all. Daniel thought his mom seemed more relaxed than she had in a while. She sat Daniel down when he got home and asked him to tell her all about his day, and after that, she just held him for a while. And Daniel had liked that. He'd liked it a lot. The scratching came again. Daniel sat up. He told himself that it was just an animal, a raccoon, or the Barham's cat, Solomon, which sometimes wandered over looking for food. The noise stopped, and he relaxed. He knew it. Stupid. The scratching was replaced by a soft tap-tap-tap on the glass, and the voice of the woman named Karis called his name.
"Daniel."
Daniel started to tremble.
"Daniel."
His stomach tightened, and he tasted something bad at the back of his throat.
"Open the window."
He let out a little moan and immediately covered his mouth. But it was too late.
"I can hear you."
"No,"
he whispered.
"Don't make Mommy mad."
And Daniel started screaming. Chapter 83. Parker's Delta flight got into Cincinnati at 8 p.m. He could have spent the night at an airport hotel and headed to Cadillac in the morning. But airport hotels depressed him. Everybody staying in an airport hotel wanted to be someplace else. So they were essentially existential dilemmas with poor bar service. So he picked up a rental car and headed west. Cadillac, according to the internet, boasted a grand total of two motels, a family-owned cabin-style place that looked like the set of a horror movie with internet reviews to match, and a Holiday Inn. Parker opted for the Holiday Inn. He arrived shortly before midnight and went straight to bed without closing the drapes, so he was woken by sunlight. He put on a casual black jacket over a white shirt and dark jeans, set off nicely by a pair of black Olokai Mauna Kea boots he'd been saving. He wanted to project a certain degree of formality when he found Layla Patton. Not intimidating, just intimidating enough. He skipped breakfast at the hotel in favor of the Sunnyside Dine-In on the town's main street. He scored a booth by the window, where he ate toast, drank coffee, read the Indianapolis Star, and watched a tall, willowy brunette with Layla stitched on the left breast of her shirt, working the seats at the counter. Layla Patton hadn't been difficult to find. There was only one Patton family on the Cadillac property register, and her social security number had recently been added to the payroll record of the Sunnyside. Parker had no intention of confronting Patton while she was at work. It had just been his good fortune to find her present when he went for breakfast. As a licensed private investigator, he had also obtained details of her vehicle from the state DMV. So he was aware that she drove the 2005 VW New Beetle parked in the employee section of the diner's lot. While making conversation, he asked his waitress, Tamira, how long shifts lasted on the floor. Based on her answer, he figured that Patton was likely to be working until 2. Even if she left early, he had her home address. But it would be better if he first approached her in a public place. She could easily close the door in his face if he called at her house, and she would be entirely within her rights to notify the police if he hung around. Cadillac was busy in the way certain small towns could be, especially those that weren't large enough to have attracted significant malls to their outskirts. God only knew what the Holiday Inn people were thinking when they opened their Cadillac outpost. Parker had only counted 10 cars in the parking lot that morning, and at least a couple of those must have belonged to staff. Parker paid the check, left the diner, and drove to the outskirts of town until he came to Dobie's. The building was locked up, and a chain prevented access to the parking lot. The letterboard sign outside read, "Business Closed," and beneath it, "Errol Dobie, R.I.P., We'll Miss You." Parker had read the newspaper accounts of the fire, but the remains of the trailers in which Errol Dobie had lived and in which he had stored what one report described as among the finest private book collections in the state of Indiana were gone. Parker stepped over the chain and walked around the property. Only blackened grass and scorched concrete marked the site of the fire that had taken Dobie's life, although Parker spotted signs of minor damage to the rear of the restaurant. 4 bouquets of flowers, 2 wilted, 2 fresh, lay in the dirt by the service door. He looked for cards or messages among them, but found none. Parker next paid a visit to the Cadillac PD, but not before making a call to Solange Corriveau. "Have you spoken to Moxie Caston?" he asked.
"I have, although certain of my colleagues expressed surprise, even skepticism at his helpfulness. And yours?"
"Let me guess. Walsh."
"I'm not going to name names."
"But I'm right, aren't I?"
"Of course you are. That apart, what can I do for you?"
"Have you ever been to Indiana?"
"No."
"Ever wanted to go to Indiana?"
"Not particularly."
"Then I may be saving you a trip, because I'm in Indiana." Parker heard the sound of paper rustling.
"Cadillac, Indiana?"
said Corriveau. "Got it in one."
"Errol Dobie."
"And Esther Bachmeyer, both of whom may have passed our Jane Doe."
"Karis, according to the man who got in touch with Caston."
"Up the line to Mela Lombardi."
"The late Mela Lombardi,"
Corriveau corrected.
"Dental records gave us a positive ID. Saved us asking the niece to view a body that had been in the water for a while."
"Cause of death?"
"Not drowning. I spoke to the ME this morning. Lombardi was already dead when she went into the water. But that's as much as I know for now. We have a recent puncture wound to one arm, though, so we could be relying on toxicology." Now you, do you have something to tell me, or are you looking for a favor?
A favor, but you'll benefit. I'm about to pay a visit to the Cadillac PD. If they want confirmation that I'm on the level, can I refer them to you?
You
shouldn't listen to Walsh. He's sore about a lot of stuff.
Still,
maybe you really do want to visit Indiana after all. But I have to tell you, the round-trip ticket was expensive, and there's not a whole lot to see once you get here, unless you're a big NASCAR fan. Come on, Carvo. If I'm not sparing you a trip, I'm saving you some groundwork.
Okay, fine. But you share everything you find out, and you don't piss anyone off. Yeah, funny.
Parker thanked her and hung up. The Cadillac PD was organized along almost identical lines to the Cape Elizabeth PD. 14 members, of whom 5 were patrol officers and 1 detective. The front desk was staffed from 8 to 5 every day, with lobby telephones directly wired to regional dispatch accessible outside those hours. It employed 4 reserve police officers and 4 reserve weekend clerks, with vacancies currently existing for 1 of each. Parker knew all this because a large sign informed him of it, and he had half an hour to familiarize himself with its details while he waited for the chief to return from whatever it was the chief was doing, which, as it turned out, was enjoying a late breakfast at the Sunnyside Dine-In, and not the first such breakfast he'd had, judging by the strain his belly was placing on the buttons of his uniform shirt. His name was Dwight Hillock, and he proved cautiously interested once Parker explained to him why he was in town.
"Trunk of a car, you say?"
"That's right." Hillock tapped his pen on his desk.
"We haven't had a request from Maine for information or assistance."
"You will."
"So why shouldn't I wait for them to call instead of talking to you?"
"Because I'm here and they're there. Solange Corvo at the MSP will vouch for me." Hillock put down his pen.
"I don't need a reference," he said. "I know who you are. I looked you up on the Google machine. You planning on shooting anyone?"
"What day is it?"
"I do believe it's Thursday."
"Nope, I'm not planning on shooting anyone." Hillock silently regarded Parker for a good 10 seconds.
"Well, all right then," he said. "Let's get started."
Chapter 84. In Ivan Giller's opinion, based admittedly on limited exposure to the subject, Greg Mullis was not Connie White's kind of guy. He lived in a dump, worked in a slaughterhouse, and his demeanor was that of someone who woke each morning anticipating only the many ways that life would find to fuck him before he could go back to bed again. He had at least managed to impregnate a woman at last. A boy, according to the expectant mother in question. But Giller believed Mullis could only have done so by keeping his eyes closed. Mullis's girlfriend might have been described as homely, but only if someone had never actually seen homely, let alone pretty. Also, judging by the ashtrays scattered around their home, the smell from her clothing, and the cigarette dangling from her right hand, her kid, if he survived until birth, would grow up to be the Marlboro Man. Giller had performed due diligence checks on Mullis before approaching him, and now knew the name of his ex-wife, her home address, the nature of the 2 jobs she held down, and the school attended by her son, or quote-unquote son, as Giller had already begun to think of Daniel Weaver. But Giller needed confirmation from Mullis of the truth of the story told to him by Connie White, that Holly Weaver could not have conceived the boy she was calling her own. This was why Giller was now seated at a thrift store table in a kitchen smelling of grease and boiled vegetables in a house that would have benefited from a serious clean, or better still, an all-consuming fire. Mullis was slouched opposite Giller, holding the business card Giller had handed to him at the door. The card identified Giller as one Marcus Light, an employee of the Office of Child and Family Services, a division of the state's Department of Health and Human Services. Giller possessed an array of such cards, some he manufactured himself, while others, as in this case, he retained when they were presented to him, or if he had an opportunity to steal them. Mullis and his girlfriend had not even asked to see some corroborating form of ID. The card had been sufficient to enable Giller to gain entry to their home. Well, the card, and Giller's assurances that they were not in any kind of trouble, and might even stand to benefit if they would answer a few questions for him. Giller never ceased to be amazed by just how gullible people could be. Mullis was 5'8" and thin but not scrawny, as though assembled from scraps of wire. He'd probably been considered good-looking once, before disappointment began whittling away at him.
"You said something about benefits?"
said Mullis's girlfriend, whose name was Tanya. In case there was any doubt about the matter, she had it tattooed on the back of her left hand, contained in the outline of a heart. On the back of her right hand, a similar heart surrounded the name of her partner.
"Benefit,"
Giller corrected her.
"I'm authorized to offer a financial reward to anyone who assists in fraud investigations."
"What kind of fraud?" Mullis asked.
"In this case, supplying false information for the purpose of registering a birth."
Tanya glanced at Mullis.
"Someone we know?"
she asked and grinned, but Mullis wasn't biting.
"Shut up," he said.
"Fuck you telling me to shut up."
But she shut up. Giller cleared his throat.
"Mr. Mullis, the fact that I'm here means we're already aware of the nature of the fraud committed. I also have to warn you that just as I'm in a position to offer a reward for any cooperation received, so too am I obliged to regard the withholding of information as a crime. This is a very serious matter. Falsification of a birth certificate is a felony, and brings with it legal penalties. Not just a fine, either. Depending on the nature and severity of the offense, we could be talking about 5 years in prison. More if the welfare of a child is deemed to be at risk."
Mullis put the card on the table and gently pushed it toward Giller.
"I don't know about any fraud," he said.
Giller saw it all now. Any rage or bitterness Mullis might have felt toward his ex-wife had dissipated with the conception of his own boy. He'd loved her once, and he wasn't about to collude in the possible removal of Daniel from her home or help put her behind bars.
"Your ex-wife registered the birth of a son 5 years ago?"
"So what?"
"Your ex-wife is infertile."
"The hell she is."
"Please don't do this, Mr. Mullis,"
said Giller, and he meant it.
"Greg,"
said Tanya,
"let's talk in private."
"I don't need to talk."
Her voice softened.
"Greg?"
She placed a hand on his shoulder.
"A minute."
And just as Giller had perceived a vestige of old love in Mullis and a basic decency not entirely excised by the years, so also did he recognize genuine affection and concern in the face of his girlfriend. It made Giller feel bad for them, and sorry that his search had brought him to their home. The couple left the room, closing the door behind them, but the walls were thin, and Giller could pick up some of what was passing between them.
"They already know."
"It's not your business."
"Think about our baby."
"Jail."
He made the call while they argued. They had already told him everything he needed to know. What would follow was out of his hands. Chapter 85. Quayle sat in a rental car across from the Weavers' property. Thanks to Giller's hard work, Quayle already had in his possession a great deal of information about Holly Weaver's life, including the school attended by the boy she was calling her son. But he had no idea what the boy in question looked like. He did know the time Saber Hill Elementary got out, though, and 30 minutes earlier had found himself a spot in a disused lot from which he could watch the road leading to the two Weaver houses. At 1 p.m., a blue Chrysler that wouldn't have been worth the price of the gas needed to get it to the dump, driven by a white-haired man in a black coat who was still trying and failing to secure his safety belt as he drove, pulled out and made the turn south. This would be Holly Weaver's father, Owen. Quayle knew all about him as well. Widowed once, divorced once, owned a big rig, not much money to speak of, and none likely to materialize at this late stage in his life. Quayle stayed behind the Chrysler until it reached the school. He took a space farther along, from which he saw the white-haired man cross the street and join the conclave of parents milling by the gate. Quayle heard the school bell ring, and moments later the first of the children began to emerge. Among them, a boy with dark hair who moved slower than the rest, as though the bag on his back weighed more than it should, but who still managed the faintest of smiles for his grandfather. Quayle released his breath, his whole body sagging with relief, like a man long burdened with illness, welcoming at last the possibility of an end to his pain. Hand in hand, Owen Weaver and the boy walked to the car, Quayle's eyes fixed on them throughout. Funny, Quayle thought, how some boys took after their mothers. He needed no further confirmation from Giller. He had found Karis Lamb's child. Chapter 86. The cell phone number was unavailable the first time Giller tried to call, but he had time for a second, more successful attempt before the shouting from outside the kitchen reached a crescendo, followed by silence. He heard footsteps approaching from the hall and put the phone away. Mullis opened the kitchen door. Tanya stood behind him, crying.
"Go on, get out," said Mullis. "We got nothing more to say to you."
"I'm really sorry you've chosen this path."
"I told you," said Mullis, "get out of my house."
The doorbell rang, not once, but continuously, the caller keeping a finger on the button. Behind the frosted glass, the figure of a woman was visible.
"Who the fuck is that?" Mullis asked.
Tanya moved toward the door.
"Don't answer it," said Mullis.
"It won't do any good," said Giller,
loudly enough to be heard over the clamor. Mullis turned back to Giller.
"What did you say?"
"I said that it won't do any good. You can't keep her out."
"You mean this bitch is with you?"
Tanya's hands had clasped instinctively over the swell of her belly, as though that might be enough to protect her baby.
"You'd best just let her in," said Giller.
His eyes were warm. He felt a tear drop to his cheek. He was crying for Mullis, for Tanya, for their unborn child, for himself.
"Let her in, and we can be done with it."
Chapter 87. Louis sat in Moxie Caston's reception area, absorbed in his reading, his long legs extended before him. He was alternating between Montaigne, The Sun Also Rises, and the New York Times. An essay, a chapter of the novel, followed by a couple of articles. When he wasn't reading, he was contemplating what he'd just read. Moxie watched him from the doorway of his office.
"You know what one of my clients asked earlier?"
"No," said Louis. He was back to Montaigne and did not divert from the book as he spoke.
"She wanted to know what crime you'd committed."
"I hope you thought carefully before you answered."
"I left it to her imagination."
"Probably for the best."
Louis turned another page, but still did not look up.
"That tie," he said.
Moxie fingered the item of clothing in question.
"What about it?"
"Just that tie."
"It's an expensive tie."
"You sure about that?"
"You want me to show you the receipt?"
"Doesn't go with the suit."
"I like contrasts."
"Good, because it's hard to imagine any suit it would go with.
It's got character.
Except a clown suit.
It's Italian.
Then maybe an Italian clown suit.
Moxie walked to the mirror by the secretary's desk and examined his reflection. His secretary, he noticed, was keeping her head down and saying nothing. He made a mental note to remind her of the necessity of supporting the man who paid her salary.
"You got me doubting myself now," he said.
"Good," said Louis.
Moxie buttoned his jacket, frowned, and unbuttoned it again.
"I guess it might be a little loud for this suit," he conceded.
"Loud for Times Square."
"Okay, okay, you convinced me. I'll change it. I'll change it and I'll never wear it again. I'll send it to Goodwill."
"Send it to clown school."
"Enough with the clowns."
Moxie skulked into his office, rummaged in his closet, and returned moments later with a more subdued tie, which he knotted in front of the mirror before turning to face Louis.
"Better?"
Louis flicked a glance over the top of his book.
"Better," he said. "Now about the suit."
From behind his back, Moxie heard what sounded like his secretary choking.
"If you're laughing when I turn around," he said, "you're fired."
Chapter 88. Dwight Hillock might have looked like he could have done with skipping a couple of meals, but he was nobody's fool. He took Parker step by step through every detail of the fire at the diner, the discovery of Errol Dobie's body, and the disappearance of Esther Bachmeyer, all without stumbling, hesitating, or referring to a single file or note.
"So the blaze is being treated as accidental?" said Parker.
"Dobie's body was badly burned, but there was no sign of injuries other than those consistent with the fire, and no trace of accelerants, paper apart."
"And Dobie liked to smoke weed?"
"Certainly did. He wouldn't be the first man to have died from dropping a lit joint. We're still waiting on the results of toxicology tests, but we won't have those for another month. On the other hand, there's the matter of Esther's disappearance, which raises a couple of flags."
"Is she a suspect?"
"Officially, we'd sure like to talk to her. Unofficially, I don't believe so."
"What about the women and girls who stayed with Dobie in the past?"
"What about them?"
"Any reason to suspect a grudge? Boyfriend? Husband?"
"We haven't ruled it out. We had the Indiana State Fire Marshal down here, and a private arson investigator was engaged to perform an origin and cause. That's still ongoing, but like I said, no sign of accelerants, or not yet. But with all that paper, a match would have been enough."
"Back to the women who passed through. You were aware that Dobie and Bachmeyer were running an unofficial shelter?"
"I was."
"Any suggestion of impropriety on Dobie's part?"
"None."
"It never crossed your mind?"
"You didn't know, Dobie. I did. I'm not pissed at you for asking. I'd do the same if I were in your shoes. But he wasn't like that."
Parker threw a few more questions at Hillock, just to clarify and confirm. When Parker was done, Hillock made a call to the department's detective, a former Indianapolis PD officer named Shears, asking him to drop by, even though Shears was off duty that day. Shears arrived shortly after, and together the three men drove first to Dobie's diner, where they went over everything a second time, with Shears adding what he could to Hillock's account, before they proceeded to the Bachmeyer house. Shears led Parker through each of its rooms, which had been examined by detectives and forensics experts from the Indiana State Police, the ISP having jurisdiction over homicides outside major urban areas. There were no signs of disturbance, but equally no indications that Bachmeyer was planning to leave for any length of time. A half-finished pint of Ben and Jerry's had even been found melted by the sink, a spoon still inside. Parker went outside and stood in the sun while Hillock and Shears locked up. He'd expected Indiana to be flat, Lord knows why, but the area around Cadillac was hilly and forested. It was a pretty setting for a town, but he still wouldn't have wanted to live there.
"And Layla Patton?"
he said when the two lawmen had rejoined him. Hillock adjusted his bulk.
Yeah, that's a strange one. Layla says she was attacked after she came back from the diner. The staff and a lot of the townsfolk went there to gather after what happened. You know, to console each other, lay flowers, say some prayers. And Layla had just returned home. She couldn't tell us much about what occurred, other than being certain it was a woman that tried to abduct her. The woman was wearing a ski mask, and as soon as it became clear that she wasn't going to be able to take Layla, she turned tail. Layla thought she heard a car pull away, but she didn't see it.
I hear Patton might have cut her attacker.
That's right. Keyed her.
You think it's connected to whatever else may have happened?
I'm keeping an open mind. This is a small town. So much occurs under the surface, like in most small towns. But to have a fatal fire, a disappearance, and an attempted abduction all in the space of 24 hours is off the scale unusual. So, yeah, a link is possible. But I can't see what it might be. Well, I can. It's got to have something to do with Dobie's girls. But it's not like Dobie and Esther kept a record of the ones who passed through. Or if they did, we haven't found it yet. Could be any papers went up with everything else in that blaze.
Layla was working on the night of the fire, right?
Yes, she was.
And she saw nothing unusual.
She says not. Other than some guy reading poetry. I don't think that's a crime. Although I guess it might depend on the poetry.
Parker looked at Hillock. Hillock looked at Parker. Parker looked at Shears.
Don't ask me, said Shears. I'm not a critic. I just work here.
Layla thought that Dobie didn't appreciate the custom of the poetry guy, said Hillock, and was acting a bit antsy after, but Dobie claimed he didn't know him. And Layla believed him. She gave us a description, but it sounded like Ralph Waldo Emerson. And not liking the look of someone wasn't unusual for Dobie. He had his peculiarities.
He didn't like men who wore sandals with socks, said Shears.
No, said Hillock, he did not.
They all considered this, decided it was pretty reasonable, and moved on. So Layla Patton is assaulted outside her home, apparently as part of an attempted abduction, said Parker. She manages to get inside her house and lock the door before calling the police. End of story.
That's it, said Hillock.
So why try to abduct her to begin with?
You're the PI with the reputation, said Hillock.
Because, said Parker, whoever this woman was, assuming it was a woman, she believed Patton knew something, or had seen something, that might aid the investigation. But according to you, Patton didn't have anything useful to offer.
Which doesn't mean she doesn't have anything to tell, said Shears. Layla Patton's a bright young woman. She's smarter than I am.
He waited for Hillock to deny this. Hillock didn't.
Nice, said Shears. So the attack could have been a warning, said Hillock.
If the fates of Dobie, Bachmeyer, and Lombardi have a common root, said Parker, then we're looking at conclusive actions, not warnings. Hillock jammed his hands in his trouser pockets and looked around for something to kick. When nothing suitable presented itself, he opted for swearing loudly. Behind him was Esther Bachmeyer's garage, and in the garage stood Bachmeyer's Nissan. Wherever she was, she hadn't driven there herself. Either way, none of the three men currently standing in her yard believed she was coming back.
I'm fond of Layla, said Hillock, once he'd purged himself some. She's a good girl. And Shears is right. She's smart.
So she could be holding out on you? Parker asked.
I guess, but I don't see why she wouldn't want to help us figure out what's going on.
Perhaps she's scared.
Yeah, but she's also tough. Her mom's been lingering for a long time. It would be a mercy if she was taken to the Lord. But I've never heard Layla complain, not once. What I'm trying to say is that if Layla Patton had information that could point toward proof of intent to do harm to Dobie or Esther, I'd expect her to tell us.
So what's she hiding? Asked Parker.
Well,
Maybe that's what you're here to find out.
Chapter 89. Giller sat at the kitchen table, staring toward the front door. Greg Mullis was